You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places, in fact, to the very streets of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. North Los Angeles Street is right around the corner from the old Plaza, Union Station, and Chinatown. And it might be the only street in LA named with the deliberate purpose of forgetting.
We are standing on Los Angeles Street in front of the Chinese American Museum.
Dr. Gay Yuen is the board chair of the museum. She's reading from a plaque embedded in the sidewalk.
On October 24th, 1871, a mob of 500 locals shot, hung, and stabbed innocent Chinese residents. 19 Chinese living on Calle de los Negros were murdered.
Now, you can't stand on Calle de los Negros to contemplate what happened here, because Calle de los Negros doesn't exist anymore. And the plaque in the sidewalk?
You have to know it's there to come by and look at it. And even as you look at it, it's so tiny that you have to squat down to read it.
Today, we continue a Greater LA series on street names with Calle de los Negros. It's a street Los Angeles staked its future on forgetting, but is now decided to remember with something more than that tiny plaque. Here's reporter Mike Schlitt.
The year of the Anti-Chinese Massacre, 1871. Los Angeles was a western outback town of about 6,000 people, a six-man police force, and a volatile stew of ethnic tensions.
These were the years of the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. 200 Chinese people, mostly single men, were in LA at the time, trying to eke out a living and survive. Calle de los Negros was the hub of where the Chinese people lived and worked.
English speakers called it Negro Alley, or that other N-word. You could still find it on a few old city maps. Calle de los Negros was named for people who used to live on the street before the Chinese. Most of the city's original Spanish settlers had African blood. The street was also home to just about every brothel, bar, and gambling joint in town. And then one night,
I doubt if there would have been a Chinese massacre had it not been a white person who walked into the middle of two Chinese men shooting it out over a woman.
Chinese rivals in a gunfight over a female prostitute. A white former saloon keeper decides to intervene. He shoots into a Chinese store, is immediately struck by return fire. He dies an hour later.
The word went out that the Chinese people were shooting white people. And so within hours, a mob of 500 came.
The sheriff instructs the mob to shoot any Chinese person fleeing the crime scene.
The people started raiding and lynching and shooting. Mob members going on top of buildings to chop holes on the roof and then start shooting randomly down. That terror and that fear is overwhelming. There were shootings on the streets and stabbings and people were hung.
By 11 p.m., the streets of downtown are quiet and empty. 18 Chinese men lie dead. 3 days later, another will die from injuries, which is why some people count 19 massacre victims, while others, like Gay Yuen, stop at 18.
Because those were the 18 names that appeared in the English newspapers. There might be 20-something who died. There might be 30. We never know.
A coroner's inquest followed. Then came arrests and murder trials. 9 men were eventually convicted of manslaughter. But just 1 year later,
the case got thrown out because Chinese people can't testify against white people. That was the law.
It's true. The convictions were overturned on appeal. All 9 killers were set free.
18 Chinamen got murdered, right? I mean, so what? Who cares? The courts didn't care.
Chinese Angelenos struggled in the aftermath of the murders, but the city was determined to move on. The tragedy became a turning point.
The latter 25 years of the 19th century, Los Angeles is very, very much on the make.
William Deverell is a historian of the American West.
Los Angeles is more than happy through its businesses, its boosters, political leadership, more than happy to blanket the world with images of the sunny Southland.
And if you're marketing yourself as a suburban paradise full of orange groves and cool ocean breezes,
a massacre is a very poor way to advertise.
And just like that, Calle de los Negros disappeared, voted out of existence by city council, while just a few feet away, North Los Angeles Street was extended two blocks.
It's urban growth. That part of downtown Los Angeles is going to be a cacophony of transit.
By the turn of the century, North Los Angeles Street had become a main transportation hub. All the old businesses, buildings, and people of Calle de los Negros were gone. Some in the local Chinese community would remember. But the rest of Los Angeles?
It's not that the rest of Los Angeles forgets the massacre. The rest of Los Angeles wasn't here. They've just gotten off the train.
All that marketing worked. Tourists, pleasure seekers, would-be land barons, they came in droves. By the turn of the century, over 102,000 people.
And is Los Angeles interested in reminding them of this massacre? No.
Today, Los Angeles has almost 4 million people, and most have never heard of the massacre. For most of her life, Gay Yuen was one of those people.
I grew up in Chinatown. I studied Asian American history, and I taught Asian American history later on. I never knew such a thing happened. I talked to Chinese people who might have grown up here, who might be second, third, even fourth generation. The first thing you hear is, I never knew that. And then the second thing is, their anger comes up.
So what did she do with all her anger?
I chose to handle it through education, and the museum is part of that education.
In 2011, the museum started commemorating the massacre every year on the anniversary.
The Chinese American Museum, they were the ones who sort of rediscovered this history because it had been lost, it had been erased.
Jason Chu is a Chinese American rapper and activist. He grew up on the East Coast.
I don't tell the Asian American story.
Jason was surprised to learn about the murders, and he found the commemorations meaningful, so he kept coming back.
You know, it wasn't large gatherings, but they kept doing it year after year. People started realizing, hey, this is something that resonates with events that are happening now. COVID-19 was somewhat of a watershed moment in terms of Asian American racial existence. It became, are you with or against us? The last 3 years have given us this odd sense of historical deja vu that really led to this renewed, restored civic memory.
Welcome to tonight's commemorative event.
On the massacre's 150-year anniversary, former Mayor Garcetti issued a public apology.
Because we need to say it. I'm sorry.
He also convened 40 historians, indigenous elders and scholars, architects, artists, curators, designers, to help the city engage more productively with its past. The Civic Memory Working Group. Historian William Deverell is a member.
We need to talk about the massacre. We need to have memorials to the victims of the massacre that are more than a plaque in a sidewalk that people stride over and have no ideas there.
That working group recommendation turned into a steering committee, co-chaired by Dr. Yuen.
There's so many stories that are not told. Doesn't mean that they can't be told in the future.
Jason Chu was invited to help pick the memorial design.
So there's been a lot of conversations about commemoration, the nature of memory.
Last fall, the committee put out a citywide open call for ideas. They got back 180 proposals, chose 6 finalists, and tomorrow they'll announce the winner.
The goal is to transform that location not only to say something happened, but to leave folks who visit with the question of what will happen.
After 152 years, the most lethal act of racial violence in Los Angeles history will finally get the recognition and the memorial it deserves. From North Los Angeles Street, formerly Calle de los Negros, for KCRW, I'm Mike Schlitt.
After the city announces what the memorial will look like, the winner of that contest, you can check it out at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Coming up, computers have been helping in dating life for a while now with all the websites and the apps. Now, one app is letting AI, artificial intelligence, give it a try on your behalf. That's yours right after this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Dating in LA can be rough, especially if you're on the apps. I mean, all that flirting and small talk only to find out they live on the other side of town. It's exhausting. Don't you sometimes wish there was someone else to do the work for you? You've been hearing a lot about AI, artificial intelligence, what with the rising popularity of ChatGPT, and the serious conversations about the dangers of AI in general.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
Oof. But maybe AI can do some good in your life and help you find your soulmate. A new dating app called Snack is here to help, and LA Times business reporter Jamie Ding gave it a shot. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Steve.
How does this work? You upload information, right? Like AI, artificial intelligence, is trying to learn from you. So what are you giving it as a consumer?
Yeah, so when you first start using this app, you have this AI that knows nothing about you, and you have to go through this process of training it and telling it more information about yourself. And so you're basically talking to a chatbot just like as if you were talking to ChatGPT, but it's asking you questions about yourself, and it could be like your favorite restaurant, your favorite hobbies, but it's also asking you some pretty weird questions like your favorite form of potato or what you'd do with $1 million. And so with these questions, it's trying to get a sense of what your personality is like, you know, how you might click with other users to be able to accurately represent you on your dating profile.
And so, you know, are you swiping left and swiping right? Is that how it goes? Or so you learn that and then it works on your behalf?
So most of the app still works just like any other dating app, and you have to do a lot of the, I guess, selection process manually. You're still scrolling through profiles, you know, looking at people's photos and videos and deciding if you like them. The only difference is that, you know, if you're gone, you're working during the day, and someone stumbles across your profile and they want to immediately get to know more about you, then they can initiate a conversation with your bot. And vice versa, if you're scrolling through people and you decide you like someone, you can start talking to their bot, because I think a lot of the difficulty with dating apps is that, you know, you get on the app, you send someone a DM, they take forever to reply, then you take forever to reply, and then at the end of the day, nothing happens. And so this is trying to speed up that process.
It's trying to speed up the process. And, you know, the one thing it bills itself, number one, it says it's Gen Z dating, right? So it's targeted toward much younger people, right?
Yeah, so the app is, I actually reported on them last year. They really focus on the younger demographic, especially with the video scrolling mechanism, you know, modeled after TikTok. And even with this ChatGPT technology-based avatar, the CEO told me that it's, you know, really young people who are kind of more used to talking online, interacting with AI, using avatars, you know, people who are talking to friends on video games, younger people who are more familiar with this kind of technology and might be more open to incorporating it into their dating lives.
Is it accurate, Jamie?
You know, I can't say it is so far, for me at least.
Really?
And I spent a lot of time, I spent a lot of time training my avatar, which is funny because, you know, I'm doing it for work. But then I had a user try to talk to me and talk to my bot, and I read the conversation, and it was really strange. It asked what that person's favorite month was, and then it was very eerie.
Favorite month? Is that a question that you would ask? What's your favorite month?
You know, I can't say it is. Not on a first date. That'd be a little strange, I think.
What's your favorite month out of the year? Well, I particularly like August, but you know. I mean,
right.
The thing about it is, yeah, it's trying to speed things up. It's trying to do things on your behalf and on everyone's behalf, right? But at the same time, it seems like it would be open to some sort of chicanery, right?
I think with any incorporation of AI, you know, we have to be careful and have safeguards against abuse. I mean, the AI will take anything you tell it as face value and repeat it to anyone. And so I can definitely see cases where with the screen of AI, people could more easily, I don't know, fool others, give false information.
We mentioned that it's geared toward a younger demographic. You talked to some people who have used this app as well. What are they saying?
Yeah, I managed to get in contact with one user that I had interacted with on the app. His name is Keenan Riggs. And he told me he actually thought that the app was working pretty well for him. He feels like it's made it easier to break the ice and start conversations with others. He thought that the questions that the chatbot asked were actually pretty funny. And even though they're unconventional, you know, it's a good way to strike up a conversation. That's just one user. So there are definitely people who are enjoying it. But I'm sure there are others who are finding that sometimes the bot's responses might not completely align with their own opinions.
Entertaining is one thing, right? To have fun with it and all of that. But what about a romantic connection? Do we know if it's really doing the work that it's supposed to be doing?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, you know, AI is still so new and this feature is so new. They're really doing a lot of testing. They're adjusting the training process, getting feedback. I think it's too early to tell whether or not this is more or less effective in fostering in-person meetups. But I think a lot of experts that I spoke to definitely said that this was one of the most interesting and unique developments in the world of online dating so far.
You gonna keep doing it? Not as a reporter, but as Jamie?
You know, I think it might be time for me to take a break from the apps for a bit, but I, you know,
yeah,
would recommend people check it out.
All right, Jamie Ding, LA Times business reporter. Jamie, thanks for coming on and talking with us. We appreciate it. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
We're now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis, and a new show called Rabid Heart opened recently at the Shulamit Nazarian Gallery on La Brea. Large format oil paintings of women and androgynous figures by Philadelphia-based artist Cody Brown fill the rooms. So picture deeply saturated images of people in public places having very, very private moments. You can almost feel like you're intruding into the scene. Our art insider, Lindsay Preston Zappas, is editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, Carla for short, and she's here to tell us more about the show. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
All right, Cody Brown and her work. It's not her first show at the gallery, right?
Yeah, this is actually her second show at the gallery. Her first was in 2021, and she recently, last year, was kind of picked up by the gallery onto their roster, so they will be working with her in the future. And she makes these really interesting, like you said, figurative paintings that are a bit ambiguous. One thing that often kind of characterizes the paintings is this sort of close crop that she does in on the figures and on these sort of scenes of intimacy in a way that's a little bit destabilizing. Like, we're kind of put a little too close into the scene. And there's also a lot of exaggeration that she does in terms of the limbs and the hands and the bodies. The clothing that she paints on these figures often ends up taking over in kind of swirls of pattern and color. And I read that she talks about painting the mood of a scene rather than the actual scene. So I think because of this, we get these sort of exaggerated moments and really dramatic lighting and strange details that sort of become really important to each of the paintings.
These paintings feel very much like you're happening, as I mentioned, upon a scene. So tell us a little more about what she's trying to capture in these moments.
I think the scenes she paints, they're sometimes in private spaces, like domestic spaces, or they're very much out in public. So imagining sort of a nightclub or on the subway, or, you know, they feel like they're very public spaces. And often it includes two or more people in close proximity, although it's very unclear exactly what's going on in these scenes. You know, often we see sort of profiles of another figure or shadows or kind of figures in the background. So there's definitely a feeling in the work of sort of like being observed or being sort of out in public where people can see you. And one thing she talks about is sort of representing society with her work and sort of all the fears and anxieties and, you know, the pressures that we all live with in everyday life. But also, you know, as a sort of female artist coming to a place of talking from sort of a feminized body and kind of the societal pressures around gender and self-image and desire. So, you know, when we look at these scenes, there's never really a super clear reading. There's a lot of kind of mixed ways that we could unpack each painting. And the expressions and even the genders are a bit hard to read as well. So I think there's a lot of contradictions embedded in each painting.
But it's like fly on the wall stuff, right? It's like B-roll, right? You're just looking at, right? This is life happening right before your eyes.
Yes. And we're like in the middle of the scene and we didn't see where it starts or where it will end.
Right.
And so that gives it this kind of destabilizing feeling.
Not a whole
sure.
lot of context. There's a piece called Out of Reach, and this is a good example of it. It kind of has this
yeah.
formality of a portrait, right? It's really colorful. But it's
yeah.
almost like you're seeing a scene in a club or something. So describe Out of Reach.
Yeah, this painting's super interesting, definitely ambiguous here. So it seems like we're at a restaurant or a club. We see a table with a white tablecloth, checkerboard flooring. But the painting is sort of waist down of the two main figures. So we don't get to see kind of the upper halves. We don't see their faces. This also makes their gender quite ambiguous. So there's a seated figure that grabs the thigh of a standing figure. And the standing figure is wearing a short skirt. Their purse has kind of fallen on the floor as well. Both of them have these kind of chunky high heels on. So, you know, it's a little bit unclear. Like, is this a violent grab of the thigh? Is this sort of a wanted sort of sexual advance? So it's a bit unclear. And then the scene is thrown off even more by this third figure who's sort of crouching under the table and has a phone that's sort of uplighting their face and staring right out at the viewer. So this figure is illuminated by their cell phone, kind of wrapped in this white tablecloth. So they look a bit ghostly. So again, there's a bunch of different ways we could read this piece and sort of understand what's happening here. There's this kind of gender fluidity of the figures. We can't see their bodies really. But the crouching figure definitely takes this into a different place. You know, she's kind of sneaking in on the scene, watching them, but very much watching us as the viewer and kind of seeing how we're going to react to this scene and what our interpretations are. And, of course, the phone here, too, you know, this other format of kind of documentation and self-presentation. So there's a lot of layers to the paintings.
Well, the show is called Rabid Heart over at the Shulamit Nazarian Gallery on La Brea in L.A. Lindsay Preston-Zappas from Carla. Lindsay, thanks for giving us some insight on it.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow on the program, elderly Californians of Japanese descent get together with one another at an annual remembrance of their family's incarceration during World War II. That's coming up tomorrow on Greater LA. Tell us what's on your mind anytime. Share a story with us and get the podcast too. It's easy. Just head to the website, kcrw.com/GLA, or you can get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts by searching KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Todd, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all help put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your time and, of course, your attention this evening. Have a great night.